Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, exploring the cultures of consciousness. Like a lot of people listening to the show, I suspect I've long had a great fascination with the Great Beast, a.k.a. Aleister Crowley. I first read the classic, rather negative biography of Crowley, the Great Beast, Simons, when I was probably 14 years old, and it totally freaked me out. I was fascinated with it. I had all sorts of peculiar dreams, and then in a fit of anti-occult anxiety, I tore up the book, and it left my life, but somehow Crowley kept popping back and continues to remain a fascinating, troubling, irritating, and sometimes deeply inspiring figure, and one who is extremely important not only in terms of the modern history of the occult in the UK and America in particular, but also in terms of popular culture and the counterculture. And so the continued attention to him is worthwhile. And there's a number of biographies now. I've read many of them, not even all of them. And so on the one hand, the news that there was a new Crowley biography out may not be incredibly exciting, except that it is written by Gary Lachman, who we've had on the show before and remains without doubt one of my favorite writers, living writers on the occult and esoteric matters. He achieves a rare alchemy in his writing of accessible and entertaining prose, deeply informed research on the characters and the rich networks of the occult, art, the avant-garde, consciousness studies, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries, and a very interesting perspective on these matters, one that is very grounded, skeptical to a degree, tart even, and yet very generous as to the possibilities of extraordinary experiences of consciousness, and a very careful moral sense of the consequences of thinking about the consequences of these consciousness experiences. How do they end up creating philosophies, styles of life? What mistakes do people make? So these esoteric figures that he's written about, Carl Jung, Rudolf Steiner, Madame Blavatsky, and now Aleister Crowley, come to life as very flawed, very human people, but also people who are struggling and creatively engaging possibilities of mind and consciousness that most conventional historians and mainstream intellectuals and writers don't acknowledge. So it's a wonderful mix, and the Crowley biography is as entertaining and insightful as I would have hoped. So I'm glad that Gary has decided to talk to us today. But before we bring him on, co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hello, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Have you been doing what thou wilt?
I do what I will.
You seem pretty do what thou wilty.
Yes, I'm pretty do what thou wilty. It's funny, though, you know, a lot of people, they misunderstand what he's talking about. And I, like you, read a lot of the sensationalist biographies about Aleister Crowley. And one of the things I always find interesting is when people write biographies about these individuals, but then don't read their works or like get into like the stuff they were actually. It'd be like if you wrote a biography on a scientist but never read any of his scientific papers. And of course that happens an awful lot as well. So I always like it if people can, you know, jump past some already established ideology of a person and look at just the reality of their life. Like you said, like include all the mistakes, all the whatever things people are going to hold judgment on, but instead to get like kind of a bird's eye view. So to get sources like this and have, you know, Gary write a book like this is important to break through people's ideas of who they think Crowley is and what actually occurred.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned writing as well, and I mean, that's one of the things that happens with these esoteric figures often is that, that people get so involved in either believing their myth or in skeptically rejecting their claims that people forget that they are, in addition to everything else, writers, and that their work as text just on those in that realm alone is fascinating. A figure like Blavatsky or Jung or all of these characters, you can find out about them by reading their texts. And Crowley, whatever else you want to say about him, and even if you acknowledge that he can be an atrocious writer, some of his poetry is you know, purple and unpleasant, but much of his writing is extraordinary, even if you don't believe or are particularly interested in magic. Just in his generation, as a writer, the amount of it, the range of it, and the weirdness of it, the peculiar mixture of philosophy and visionary poetics and the imagination, it's just it's a really interesting ride, and it's one of the nice things about Gary's book is that he also gives you good pointers on what he thinks are some of the most interesting texts and reasons that Crowley wrote them. So, but with all this in mind, let's bring Gary onto the show. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's entirely my pleasure, Eric, and hello to you too, Maja.
You know, so you know, I knew this was a long time coming. I think the last time we talked on the show, you had mentioned that this was your forthcoming project. But in some ways, it seems to me that he's a particularly interesting character for you, because if you go back to Turn Off Your Mind, this your first big book, that in a way Crowley is as central to that story as he is to the history of the occult earlier in the 20th century and the end of the 19th century. This moment of the 60s, this moment of your own kind of youthful experience, youthful explorations, was there something a little closer about Crowley for you in terms of your own life than some of these other figures that you've written biographies about more recently?
I mean, that's how I start the book, because my interest in all this sort of thing began when I was introduced to Crowley's work in New York in 1975. And I should point out that when you say my youthful experience of the 60s, the emphasis is on youth. I was a kid in the 60s. It's bad enough that I had my coming of age in the 70s, but let me you know, gain a decade at least or something here. But that's how I you know, became aware of the whole Western esoteric tradition. When I was living on the Bowery in New York in early 1975, when I was playing with Blondie, you know, on the whole New York CBGB scene. We lived a block away from CBGB, and we were living in this loft, rundown loft space, and Chris and Debbie, Chris Stein and Debbie Harry, I'd already been living with them in Little Italy in a tiny little flat, and they had a kitschy interest in all this kind of stuff, in voodoo and, you know, black magic and upside down pentagrams and evil eyes and stuff like that, and, you know, because it was weird, and I mean, they weren't really serious about it, but in a kind of folky, you know, urban folklore kind of way. And then one of the people who lived at the loft was this flamboyant artist fellow who did these big paintings of tarot figures, and he based them on Crowley's tarot, which was still relatively rare then. And I just was, you know, fascinated by these things. And then there were two books I borrowed at that time. One was Crowley's Moonchild, which I read and got into. And another one was Colin Wilson's book, The Occult, which had come out, I think, in 1971. And there was all this debris sort of left behind from the 60s generation in the mid 70s period too. So, and there were a lot of hipsters from that time hanging out as well. So there was a strange blend. It doesn't come through in the music from that time, but in sort of the milieu I was moving in, it was there. And I just was knocked out by Colin Wilson's Occult. I mean, readers of my books know that he's a big influence on me, on that book in particular. And the chapter that he has on Crowley in there, and also about Yeats and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn so on and so on, just fascinated me. And this artist in the loft, he was into Crowley. He used to do these readings of Diary of a Drug Fiend, and, you know, we would, you know, indulge and get into it and all that kind of thing. I just became fascinated. And there was a sort of golden age of cheap occult literature that time as well. There's a great old bookshop, Weiser's, in the East Village. It's not there anymore, but they had a lot of stuff for sale, and a lot of remainders of occult classics, A.E. Waite's books and the Egyptian Book of the Dead and books by MacGregor Mathers and so on and so on. So it's sort of my, you know, my introduction to this, and that's how I start the book. And it's also, after a few years of getting deep into Crowley, I got disenchanted with not magic or the occult, clearly, because I, you know, later went on to write books about it, but with Crowley's own kind of approach to it and his own you know, supersized ego. But yeah, it was much closer to me in the way that you say. And also the point, one of the ideas of the book is, why did Crowley turn out to be this rock and roll icon when other people from the 60s, like Jung and Blavatsky, in this period, you know, I wrote about and that you mentioned, this mystic 60s, they didn't stay sort of youth culture kind of icons, but Crowley did, and he was picked up. Why did that happen?
Yeah,
so, that's a kind of running question throughout the book.
In a way, that question is sort of, those are kind of both, I suspect that there's a relationship between the reasons that you grew disenchanted with Crowley as a occult philosopher, as a system of magic, and the reasons that he remains large in the popular culture imagination. It seems to be just a kind of a relationship there around rebellion, anti-authoritarianism, mm-hmm. excess.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole. I mean, the book, I kind of use Crowley as a poster boy for a critique of this philosophy of excess. I mean, one of Crowley's close friends, a fellow named Lewis Wilkinson, who wrote under the name Lewis Marlowe, he said that Crowley's cult was excess in all directions, which sounds like a really great album title. I say in the book, I think we owe him a debt of thanks because he took that idea and he ran with it. And in a way, he showed us that it doesn't work. He's not the only one. There are many figures, and I name-check quite a few in the book. But I sort of want to, you know, connect him with the whole kind of general kind of not only rock and roll, but it emerged with the Beats. It emerged with the Surrealists. And it's what the late historian Jacques Barzin, who I think died last year at the age of 107, called this yearning for an unconditional life. And this is a kind of thing which is immensely attractive to all of us. We all go through it. I mean, you're talking about reading John Simmons' book when you were 14 or 15, you know, and that's, you know, that's in a way, that's kind of in one sense, it's the time to read it, or, you know, because you're hemmed in by parental constraints, and, you know, society wants you to do certain things, and, you know, you're kind of cut off here and there, and you're frustrated, and here's this guy who just went for it, you know, who lived large without worrying about anything. And when you're in that adolescent into early teens, and even, you know, early manhood period, that's infinitely attractive. And I think it's also, as that's attractive in the individual as we develop, it's also attractive in the culture. You know, you can see it.
Well,
at different
and what
times.
Do you think about that? Like, I mean, because I feel like that's so true. I mean, here's an individual that's promoting this rebelliousness, but then also in the interest of freedom, regardless of, you know, whatever misperceptions may be there. I mean, you know, the Marquis de Sade was doing that as well. But then, like, the fact that it's these creative people, like musicians and people, you know, that are making stuff would then adhere to him in particular in that role of, like, the ability for the mind to have that sort of freedom into hedonism. Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you compare that to, say, something like Burning Man, meaning the people who, like, started Burning Man, maybe not necessarily...
Well, I'm not the one to ask, because I've never been, and I don't know much about it, other than that it's, you know, a fantastic festival that is mythic, as far as I know. So you probably know more about it than I do. But, I mean, it's the whole... The thing is, I hope I don't come across in the book as being conservative and wanting to sort of now, you know, let's not get out of control, damp your enthusiasm, or curb your enthusiasm. but it's to me, this there hasn't been a critique of this kind of sensibility within the culture itself. It's come from outside.
Right.
It's come from the moral majority or whatever, some external entity. And I think the whole idea of the counterculture and, you know, what it is today, this multiple subculture, a variety of different things, it's been going on for long enough to have produced its own kind of critics. And in a way, I think that's what I've been doing. I didn't consciously set out to do this, but looking over, you know, the books I've written over the last decade or so, it seems that that's what I've been doing, is kind of producing a kind of critique within the, you know, the culture itself. And again, one of the things I point out in the book is that, you know, I was in both the rock and roll milieu and the magical one, because in the late 70s, when I moved to Los Angeles from New York, I joined the OTO and I joined Crowley's AA, and it was I really got into it. You know, I went the whole thing for a couple years. So you know, in a way, I sort of want to say, well, you know, I not only talk the talk, I walk the walk. At least 30-something years ago, I did. But I'm aware of the value of the.
Yeah, no, and I think that comes through.
I want to be able to say, well, you know, maybe we've kind of matured enough to look at this and question it ourselves without, you know, the others, the elders doing it.
Right. No, I think that comes through, and I think that one important distinction that you do make in the book, and that's also important when we talk about, particularly about Crowley and the whole logic of rebellion, is like the sort of conventional critique is you just look at the excesses and you say, look at the ruined lives, the women he abused, the people who went crazy, his drug addiction, he's, you know, taking this massive amount of drugs by the end of his life, and, you know, the sort of, there's a kind of repulsive character of some of his excesses, and that's sort of a more predictable way looking with the negative guys at some of his lifestyle, if you will. But I think a more important critique is just this idea that you come back to. Actually, two really I think important ones. The one is that, you know, in order to be that character, you have to constantly be rebelling against some idea of an outside authority who's keeping you down. In essence, maintaining that perspective of the adolescent who's rebelling against the parents, who's rebelling against his Christian upbringing. And so in some sense, in a very simple way, as a person, as a personality, Crowley never really grew up, because he needed to constantly, you know, push himself back into the sexual shame he was supposedly imprinted by and rebelling and overcoming it, and yet he never really got out of that rut and got to that, in a way, scarier place where maybe there is no law that's forcing you to be restrained, or if it is, it's just convention, and what you have to do is come up with your own sort of framework, your own sort of way of accommodating your relationship with the inevitable constraints of the world, which we associate with something like maturity. And in some sense, he just didn't go there.
I think you hit the nail on the head. The idea is, it's like Nietzsche, who said, many lost what was best in them when they lost their chains, meaning that, you know, there's a difference between freedom from and freedom for. And I think in many ways Crowley confused the two. He very often did have a notion of freedom for. I think he had some instinct about, this is what the true will, there was some instinct about something more important than the conventional life that he, you know, like many of us, we want something more than that. But it's some deeper meaning. It's not necessarily living in some strange, you know, exotic, eccentric way, which, you know, we do at a certain time, you know, perhaps, but, you know, we tend to, down the line, have to basically, you know, kind of create some sense of order around us. But I think he had some instinctive sense of that, but it was mixed up with his own ego and his own kind of self assertiveness and this ineradicable instinct to, you know, rebel against this early restraint. And this was something he carried around with him, and I think that's something that hampered him. You know, he kind of, I think in some ways, as Gurdjieff says, he sort of crystallized at a certain point, and it was, you know, really, you know, almost impossible for him to sort of act in a different way. But at the other set, you know, the other side of it, you know, he was brilliant. He did have flashes of genius. He did have insight into human potential, and I think in his own kind of tumultuous way, he was trying to actualize that. But you know, more often than not, his own kind of need to, you know, take everything, you know, to the hilt kind of you know, worked against him.
Well, here's an interesting question, though. In one way, the form of the biography in relationship to his work and his life is, on the one hand, extremely attractive because there's such crazy stories. He lived such an outsized life. There's mountain climbing and drugs and absolutely amazing, bizarre, magical rituals, all sorts of characters, you know, traveling around the world, spying. I mean, it's just, the story is so incredibly rich. But sometimes I fear that there's sort of not a disservice, but that there's a distorting effect because his life was such a huge, glorious mess, that it's harder to see the way in which, if you just approached him as a writer or as someone who is thinking and writing about magic, not necessarily practicing it, like leaving that aside, it's fascinating. I mean, just the, you know, there's, you know, dozens of texts and books that you mention in your biography that you have absorbed and read and reread over the years. You know, some of them are brilliant, some of them are mixes, some of them have, you know, ridiculous excessive writing in it, but there's still this tremendous substance as a thinker, as someone who's trying to wrestle with the new dynamics of the 20th century, who's trying to take into account our capacity for extraordinary states of consciousness. So how would you sort of frame him or introduce him, almost, if you will, just as a writer, just as someone who's amassed this body of spiritual, magical texts?
Well, you hit on a really good point. I think what would do Crowley a good service is someone to edit a collection of some of his essays or prose writing, not the poetry, not the Book of the Law, not necessarily you know, the novels. But he wrote, he was one of the early sort of scientific explorers of consciousness, let's say, a self-experiment in the way, say, that William James was, you know, who experimented with nitrous oxide, I think once, maybe twice, I don't know, but Crowley a bit more, and several other drugs as well. And some of his best writing is about his experiences on drugs. I even thought of pitching somebody, you know, an anthology titled Aleister Crowley on Drugs, you know, which is, you know, a couple of...
Seems like not a bad
there.
Idea.
And also, you know, some of his critical writing is very good, you know, and one of the best things he did is these late lectures on yoga that he gave in the 1930s. I mean, they're absolutely brilliant, and they're sparkling, and they're crystal clear. But again, one of the things with Crowley is that he wasn't a good critic of his own work, and he didn't accept criticisms from others. So he can, you know, there's certain kind of... things he does that he indulges in, like one of the things I point out in the book is alliteration. You often find, you know, a lot of alliteration, and especially when he's being vituperative. If there's somebody he doesn't like, he can really let go with it, And, you know, so there's an excessive quality to that, too. But, no, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, there's parts of book four, which was his first attempt to write a sort of systematic, book about magic, which to my taste is much more accessible than the magnum opus Magic in Theory and Practice, which, you know, is pointed to as his sort of, big book of magic, which it's fascinating in one sense if you know about him. If you don't know about him, I think the average reader coming to it seems impenetrable.
No, that's true. And there is something, and there's a point you make that I thought was very interesting. Early on, you suggest that there's an autistic characteristic to Crowley. And, you know, in a way, right now, I think in our culture, we're finding traces of autism all over the place, but for good reasons in some place. It's like we're identifying a certain kind of character type or a certain kind of relationship to information or an obsessive quality that a lot of people who produce interesting and perceptive work have. And there is something about that to his work that also makes it kind of interesting if you're willing to do the work or to sort of play the game, because there's an encoded puzzle, self-referential quality to his magical work in particular. I mean, I'm thinking of Robert Anton Wilson here, who was very influenced by Crowley in a number of interesting ways, but one of his first great loves was the Book of Lies, not one of Crowley's most substantial works, but a very interesting one. But one is full of puns and playfulness and encoded cryptic quality. So there's a sort of puzzle-like quality to his writing, his worldview, his magical universe, that if you want to play the game, in some sense, perhaps that's all it really is, that there's a lot of richness and resonance, but from the outside, you're going to be like, "What is this about?" what is he? But it's
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the Book of Lies is a good example because in my book, I say it's something like Zen Koans, but less accessible. You know, in the sense that it is this. There's so many layers, and it's so self-reflexive. But if you don't know about Kabbalah, and if you don't know about the Book of the Law, and if you don't know about a variety of other of Crowley's obsessions, it's going to be very difficult to decode this. And that's true of Magic in Theory and Practice as well, because there's lots of trap doors, there's lots of labyrinths, there's lots of references to at the time it was written, it wasn't known that Tu Megatherion and Frater Perturabo were the same person. And this was a kind of gimmick that a lot of occult and sort of writers from that time did. They would refer to aliases of themselves as other people. This element of self reflexivity, to speak postmodern talk, has been picked up by some of Crowley's biographers, and they argue for him being a modernist and all that kind of thing. And, you know, perhaps in some way that's true, but his actual writing isn't very much like that. He was pretty much, you know, stuck in the late 19th century, certainly the poetry. But the autistic stuff, I mean, I wouldn't go so far to say he was, you know, pathologically autistic, but there is this obsessiveness and there's this exactitude that comes through with him too. I mean, I call him an impossibilist in the book, because this is kind of his motto. If somebody says it can't be done, that's what I'm going to do. And again, there was this kind of itch to do that. Basically, I'll show them. You say you can't do it? And that's one reason why he picked magic out of all the things to have him make a career on. Magic was considered, you know, completely, just superstition, and it was tossed into the dustbin of history, and so on and so on. And who would believe that anyone could raise spirits in the 20th century or whatever, and all that? And Crowley said, "Well, I will," you know. So there's this kind of urge to do what somebody tells him he can't do, which in a way is this obstinate kind of little boy. It's admirable.
But it's also scientific as well. If you think
absolutely. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it is admirable at times, this persistence that most of us don't have. He will keep, if he's got the scent, he will keep going.
Yeah.
But it's also, there's times when you want him to turn it off. At least I do.
So I have another question for you. As someone who takes magic and esoteric work very seriously, and who yourself went into the OTO and went into Crowley's magical work. How what would you say to critique not the man, not the personality so much, but what is it about his philosophy, his conclusions, his style of magical work that seems flawed or problematic to you?
Well, I mean, I'm no longer a practicing, you know, magician. I did, you know, stuff like that many years ago. I think in general his obsession with, you know, the Book of the Law and the Beast and the Scarlet Woman and all that kind of thing. Because this is just, to me, it's just so much of his sexual obsessions. And certainly he modernized it. And one of the things I point out in the book is that Crowley, he realized that all of the, you know, paraphernalia, all of the kind of accoutrements the work of standard sort of rituals with, you know, getting the magic circle just right and the names just right and all of that are not necessary, because what's necessary is to awaken the creative genius, basically. These are somehow means of doing it. And he was able to do it himself. He claims that he completed the Abramelin ritual while he was on horseback, you know, somewhere on the border between China and Burma. You know, for those of you listeners who don't know, the Abramelin magic is this ritual from the Renaissance period that was aimed at putting one in touch with one's holy guardian angel, a higher self, or actually some being from a higher dimension. And Crowley was able to visualize everything he needed in his head. So he had tremendous powers of imagination and visualization. But he, you know, he kept going back to acting it out. So I think in a way he sort of, you know, he had insights, but he didn't follow them through all the way. He was too much into the whole song and dance, let's say, along with it.
Right.
But I think one of the things I suggest in the book is that he had some way of inducing synchronicities. I think he had some trick of throwing himself into the unconscious in some way and triggering things. And it didn't always work, but, you know, it worked often enough for him to have faith in it.
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of questions I have for you here, but we're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Gary Lachman about his new biography of Aleister Crowley. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis. We are speaking today with Gary Lachman about his new book on Aleister Crowley and rock and roll. And before the break, you talked about something that is so important to me, and I feel like it is the diamond of all occult work, which is to access the higher self. Okay, pretty much if we can zoom out and just view this in terms of, like, the accumulation of religion, spirituality, and all this kind of meditation work and yoga and all over the world, most of the techniques are trying to get you to that place, which Crowley claims to have arrived at through his own methodology. And this is something that is talked about in ancient Greece, in religion, hooking up with your conscience, that higher self, the Christ light. There's like a bazillion words for it. So what's interesting to me is, in my research, when you look at these individuals that can do that can hook in, so to speak, right? Whether it's creatively, musically, spiritually, how, whatever form that link up with that otherness in terms of consciousness occurs, you'll see these people's lives and kind of like what happens. And, you know, of course, a lot of them follow mental illness patterns, like you were saying, like with alliteration, or you can view like all of these things any occultist talks about in terms of, you know, schizophrenia or mental illness as well, since there's, you know, like you said, imagination, but sometimes that like crosses into hallucination, then we got drug use and all this kind of stuff. So if you look at him like that, as this kind of like person who was trying to, you know, experiment or attain these things, but then didn't quite like make it in those, you know, religious and spiritual terms. They call this the Messiah complex, and kind of like, you know, what happens when you don't do that job of breaking your ego that like all the kung fu senseis try so hard to, you know, give you that ability to go through the ego. Do you, in your research on him, do you really feel, or do you think there's some connection of that in particular, like when people just are like doing this stuff and trying to get into that subconscious and doing this work to do it, but there is that sort of wrong way people go into that, you know, Messiah, schizophrenic, I am Jesus type of mindset that happens to, you know, people in the music industry as well, certainly.
Well, I think it happens in all walks of life. But
yeah.
Crowley's alliteration, just that point, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, point to that as evidence of him, you know, being mentally unbalanced. It's just poor taste, as far as I'm concerned. But I know exactly what you mean. I mean, no, Crowley made no bones that he considered himself the word of the Aeon. He was the avatar of this new age of force and fire, the crowned and conquering child, which makes, you know, perfect sense. You know, that's what he was given to do. And he proselytized for the true faith, much as his father did for the Plymouth Brethren, the you know, Christian fundamentalist sect that Crowley was brought up in. And I think the thing with Crowley, though, is that his attempt or his struggle to overcome the ego was too much wrapped up in his own ego. In a way, it was always him doing it. I mean, this is one of the things that I found strangely remarkable about him, is that he had enough experience for, you know, 25 different lives, but he's pretty much the same person at the end of it as when he begins. He doesn't really change. He does an enormous amount of incredible things. You know, he climbs mountains, he's a chess master, he travels around the world, he takes, you know, numerous different drugs, he travels on the astral plane, he meets incredible people, he sleeps with dozens of women, and he's the same person at the end of it that when he starts. And so there's a kind of fixed quality to him. And I think, again, this whole notion of transcendence, this transcending the ego, this going through the abyss is what he calls it, in terms of moving up the, you know, the tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree of life. And he this is also working his way up the sort of magical totem pole of the Golden Dawn system. And he wants to get past, you know, he wants to get up to the supernals, you know, the three top Sephiroth of the tree of life. And this is, they're beyond, you know. I mean, there's even more beyond that, but they're beyond enough for us. And he basically is flinging himself into this, and he wants to achieve this kind of complete non-attachment to things. But it's still him that has it, you know, if you know what I mean?
The threads of your book that I found the most original in terms of thinking about Crowley is this, the problem of what you call indifferentism. And it's a long-standing conundrum in spiritual and esoteric work, especially in the modern world, with all our sort of philosophical confusions. And it's this idea that the supreme experience, the moment of enlightenment, the sort of fusion with the all, there's no difference between this or that. There's no real difference between different actions, perspectives, images, ideas, experiences, decisions, et cetera, because it's all networked, it's all one. And these kinds of experiences happen. They happen to, like, as you point out, William James on nitrous oxide, the sort of way that everything links together as a kind of drug experience, but also many states of meditation and insight and ecstasies were all one. But then something happens in terms of how does that become crystallized in when, you know, the day after, when you return to a dualistic frame of mind. And it seems to me that one of your most penetrating philosophical problems with Crowley is the way that he sort of used that oneness or that indifferentism, which undoubtedly came out of some of his experiences, and that seems pretty clear from his diaries and his magical diaries. And yet that sort of became kind of, I mean, to put it simply, sort of license just to do what he wanted to do, but also a sort of weird lack of engagement that allows such fixation. It's like when we're not actually engaged with the consequences of the decisions we make in our ordinary lives, there's a sort of, there can be a kind of vagueness that doesn't allow change because you're not really engaged. You're just kind of floating in this sort of haze. And he had a sort of very, you know, Dionysian form of that haze. But I'm really interested in that problem and how you think about it as a, you know, someone interested in spirituality, as someone who's wrestling with the consequences of different states of consciousness, how to move through that kind of all is one state and maybe wind up somewhere different than someone like Crowley does.
I think you're absolutely right. And if I have to say so myself, I think that is one of the most important parts of the book and questions that I try to raise. And I think the thing is that we can't, you know, we have those experiences, and I think they can reconcile us to the contradictions of the world, and they can reconcile us to pain and suffering and inequity and variety of all those things. But we can't, we don't live on that plane all the time. And I think there's, it's very problematic to take it literally. And I think this is, again, this is an example of kind of Crowley's exactitude and his impossibilism, because he's always, he's constantly saying that he wants some kind of action to prove that he can exist, you know, without attachment, when he's already done this already. He's been doing it all his life, but he keeps saying there's some kind of reflex action where he keeps wanting to do something, to do some completely bizarre act. And again, this itself is a romantic notion that if only you do something so radical that will completely change things. Well, we all know that doesn't happen. It's just not like that. You know, you may feel like that for a moment. And what that suggests to me more than anything else is this kind of frustration where your energies are not being directed into anything purposeful. They're not being directed into any creative channel, and they're building up and building up, and you have this terrible sense of frustration, and you must do something. I'm going to smash that window, or, you know, or as Crowley did when he was an adolescent, make sure that a cat really doesn't have nine lives, and kill it nine times. You know, there's some need to transgress. This to me is, again, this is lined up with the whole notion about transgression, but I'm drifting away. No, I think you're right. I think this is a major question. I mean, those moments, you know, if we're lucky, we have one or two in our lifetime when we do have the sense of the unity of all things, and this sense of reconciliation. But as William James said, he recognized when he was under nitrous oxide that it was true that we lived in the midst of an infinity. But that recognition led to a kind of, well, it doesn't matter what I do because everything equals out in the end.
What's fascinating to me is that, you know, many individuals can have those realizations of oneness and networking and that it's all connected, and yet the choice they make to exhibit in their practices is to remove, disassociate, and isolate themselves from all the other human beings they're interacting with. Like, how curious is it that Crowley would, you know, have an experience of that, or say that he did, of that oneness, and then in real life, like, to bring that, like you said, that problem of bringing that into the real physical reality, I mean, his actions would make sure that that would never become his reality, because he was not, absolutely not connected to people, at least emotionally or empathetically, perhaps, like, you know, on his intelligence level or whatever. But, I mean, do you feel like that's what the point, that we can bring it back in, is to remain connected even within
I think you're absolutely right. He wasn't emotionally connected with the people around him, but it was this rationalization, you know, everything
right.
is all one, everything is all connected, it doesn't matter. And he himself ties himself into logical knots in his diaries when he's trying to accommodate this vision to his own destiny as what he calls an ameliorist, who is one that makes things better. And he's trying to make things better by teaching people how to get to their true will. But if it doesn't matter what you do, if everything is one in the end, so, you know, it doesn't matter whether they find their true will or not. And so he tries to get beyond this, and he basically thinks himself into knots. And it is a deep logical problem. But no, I think you're right. I think most of us, if we have those moments, those perceptions, we're more reconciled to people around us. You know, we don't necessarily, you know, hug them, but we realize, right, well, we're all in this together. You know,
yeah,
life is a tough business. You know, and you're less kind of self-centered. But for Crowley, they were more like confirmation of this way of life that he already adopted, of being unattached to everything, in a sense. I mean, I don't want to appear as reductionist, but I point out an early experience of his when he was in his late teens, when he was staying with the family of some other Plymouth brethren, you know, fundamentalists. And what had happened, make a long story short, the daughter wanted to marry this boy who was not, you know, part of the cult, and family wouldn't let her, and all that. And he took her side, and it got into a big, you know, scandal about it and all that. And by this time, his family had just got sick and tired of trying to control him. And he came away from it, and he realized, you know, by now I would be left alone to do what I wanted. And I think this is something that motivated him. He wants to justify this notion of just leave me alone, let me do what I want to do, I am following my orbit, and the rest of you should follow your orbit too. And if orbits cross, it's not my fault. I'm following my true will. Everyone else is kind of off kilter. So it was this attempt to, I think he, you know, he tried to find a metaphysics to justify this sense of lack of responsibility to, you know, to the people around him. This is another thing. This is a struggle. You know, I think we've been trying to do this kind of thing long enough to realize, well, there's a conflict here between our responsibility to ourselves, to self-actualize, to become, you know, who we are, and then our responsibility to the world we live in and the people around us, because, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. And you know, I think Crowley, you know, really tried to ignore that side of the thing and just went, you know, let me develop myself, basically, and had this kind of Buddhist philosophy to help him, where, you know, everything is all, you know, illusion anyway. So,
well,
I mean,
we don't have too much time here, and I definitely wanted to give a little bit of room for the question of Crowley's legacy. Your last chapter is all about the kind of cultural influence of Crowley, particularly starting in the 1960s with the occult revival, and then his, you know, tremendous influence, his kind of second life as a figure within rock and roll in a wide variety of ways. And at the very end, you point out that even beyond that story of the kind of 60s counterculture and the attachment to him as a rebel and as a prophet of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the kind of dark side of heavy metal with the Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, all that stuff is, in a way, is kind of a known or at least understandable story. But yet his figure persists, you know, into the you know, the hip hop Masonic conspiracies, and, you know, Christians concerned about popular music are still talking about Crowley. And how do you, you know, explain this? How do you account for, even beyond the sort of 60s moment, his sort of continued force in popular culture?
Well, I mean, you know, I think you said earlier, his ethos, you know, his sort of excess in all directions lends itself to most youth culture or some forms of it. And I think by now, you know, I said Crowley's that face has been around in lots of different contexts. You know, that classic photo of him with the shaved head and the bulging eyes. I mean, that's almost as ubiquitous as Che Guevara or Marilyn or something like that. You know, around here in London, I see it in different contexts. And you'd almost see him as a kind of one of those Andy Warhol, you know, celebrity paintings he did, where he took the photograph and then just, you know, splotch some color on it or something like that. I'm not a devotee of contemporary pop, so this was, you know, research I had to do, actually. But I was surprised that the Crowley franchise was still running, still going strong. And you know, he's picked up by, you know, a couple different rappers, Jay-Z, famously, in one of his videos or an interview about with him about a video, had a hoodie on that said "Do With That Wilt" on it. There's some other singers who had a glitzy kind of jacket that had Golden Dawn insignia on the back of it. And there's all sort of Eye in the Triangle images coming up. And what I get from it, it sounds like more of a sense of elitism rather than the kind of liberationist ethos that Crowley was emblematic of, say, in the 60s, or the satanic that, say, in the kind of kitsch satanic in the 70s and so on. It's this kind of elitism, and it's hooked up with the whole notion of the Illuminati, you know, the people who are really in power, the people who are really in control of things. But at the same time, Crowley, while he's still being kind of milked for this threatening quality, you know, this kind of scary kind of aura around him, he's become more and more acceptable. One evidence for that is here in London in the National Portrait Gallery, which has, you know, paintings of famous upstanding, you know, British characters. There's a portrait of Crowley, which is remarkable, because in his day it would never have happened. I mean, but it's there. And I was completely surprised when I saw it. But at the same time, he's also been picked up by innocuous kind of pop acts like the Jonas Brothers. I mean, the only reason I know about them is my sons used to watch the Disney Channel, and their TV show was on. They were kind of like modern day monkeys, but there's one of them is, you know, there's a shot of one of them wearing a T-shirt with that photo of Crowley's bulging eyes and you know, prominent Erich von Stroheim, bald pate, and quite a few others, you know. So he's and sadly this poor woman Peaches Geldof.
Well, in a way, it also that,
I mean,
that
she, you know, she was photographed with the OTO tattoo on her, and you know, she said his books were super interesting, you know. So it's at the same time as he's still being kind of peddled as this threatening kind of character, he's also really been homogenized and just made part of the kind of, you know, pop cultural mulch now.
Well, in a way, that points to some of the problems with the culture of transgression, which is such an important part of the 20th century, you know, going back to the earlier era of the avant-garde and then having it kind of explode in the 60s and even go into, you know, postmodernism with Foucault and, you know, this whole long legacy, rich legacy, crazy, over-the-top legacy of transgression, you know, now in our sort of truly postmodern environment, if you want to call it that, it's like the whole difficulty of transgression is to construct the other against which you're transgressing, because it sort of seems like every opportunity, every move, every weirdness, every excess is sort of already part of the smorgasbord of options in, you know, cultural capitalism. And so you almost have to trick yourself into thinking that there's someone preventing you from doing something in order to get the frisson of transgression.
I'm one of the points I try to make is we all of us need to grow beyond that. You know, we really need to develop something that isn't just you know, a reaction to something else. It isn't just, you know, rattling these imaginary chains. We have to be serious enough to develop a new, you know, kind of philosophy that isn't just a counterculture philosophy, but is a new creative, actual, you know, viable philosophy that can help, you know, deal with the problems that the world faces. And I don't necessarily mean any kind of activism and that kind of thing. But it's going beyond this, you know, conventional bourgeois versus the, you know, wild, erratic transgressive. I mean, those two things just keep, you know, swinging back and forth, and we need to go, you know, something beyond that. I'm not saying I have the answer, but I recognize that's a real problem. And I think, you know, it's an interesting time because, you know, the whole transgressive thing, it's bleeding out. It's becoming mainstream, because what do you see most photographs of now? At least I do when I go on the net. It's like half naked or fully naked people, mostly women, you know, and it's like, well, what else can you do anymore? We really are running out of things, you know, taboos to break.
Well, here's a question. Since we are at this moment of crisis, people looking for meaning, it's totally overwhelmed with technology, blah, blah, blah. We all know the story of apocalypse on the horizon. What role do you see that these peculiar and extraordinary states of consciousness have to play in our moment. I mean, one of the things that really marks you as a distinctive voice is that even though you are very historically informed, you're quite skeptical about many things. You're not interested in peddling romantic myths about magic or esotericism. Nonetheless, you take certain capacities of human consciousness, synchronicity, higher states of mind, perhaps telepathy, seriously as options, and that you take these things seriously as parts of people's experience. Obviously, those things remain very controversial. A lot of people think there's nothing there. What role do these things have to play? This will have to be the last question in trying to find our way in our moment right now.
Well, I think this will sound trite, but I think the answer, or at least one direction to move in, is through understanding our own consciousness. I think we need to take on board the evidence from these, you know, so-called anomalous or strange experiences, and also connect them to experiences we have every day. I'm working on my next book is sort of going to address that, at least one part of it. But that's why I think people like Crowley and Gurdjieff and Steiner and Jung and Uspensky and Swedenborg and Blavatsky and all the others I've written about are important, because they show us possibilities, they show us potential, and we don't have to go through all the things they went through. We can see what they've left us, and we can take it from there. And I think what we need to do is apply the same kind of rigor and precision that someone like Crowley did often apply to his own experience, to our experience, trying to map out this kind of cartography of consciousness and learn how to understand and enter into these kinds of states more often. And that doesn't mean to me that we need to be in some ecstatic bliss state. It's just I think we need to learn how to, that our consciousness isn't necessarily passive. We actually have more control over it than we understand, but we don't quite know how to work it. And
wonderful.
People like,
well, we're gonna have to end it there. Gary, thanks so much for joining us in Expanding Mind.
So thank you for having me on.
Great. So Gary Lachman, his new book, Aleister Crowley. Check it out. It's really great. And from me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.